Hey everybody, welcome to The Trout Show. This is The Trout, a.k.a. Rick Troutman, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 1 of The Trout Show Podcast. If you're new to this podcast, let me tell you what I do. I interview extremely talented musicians located all over this planet, and this episode is no exception. Our guest today is Andy Aldort, a guy that's been playing guitar for a while, but his claim to fame is he got to play with the Jimi Hendrix Band, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's also jammed with Johnny Winter, hung out with Stevie Ray, performed with Dickie Betts on tour for years. He's been the associate editor of Guitar World for a long time. His website, andyaldort.com, he teaches people how to play all sorts of guitar, whether it's blues, slide, anything you want to know. I was very happy that Andy sat down with me to talk about his history of music and the people he's met along the way. So sit back and enjoy this episode of The Trout Show with Andy Aldort. Next. How did you get involved? Obviously, you were a Hendrix fan, but it had to be a few years later because you were really young at the time when Jimmy died, right? You were like 14, I think.
Well, I was 14 when he died, yeah.
So when did you, I mean, how did you get involved with Buddy and...
Oh, Billy,
I mean, they had.
It's relatively simple. The first part of it is, as a guitar player, when I started to become more serious about playing guitar when I was 17, I mean, I love almost every style of music that there is, except for maybe opera, and not that big on polkas, but Hendrix, I really, really loved, really loved. And I'll never forget when I was 12 years old, Electric Ladyland came out in 1968. I was at summer camp, and somehow it was like dusk, and for whatever reason, I was alone in the bunk, like I wasn't out with my campmates doing whatever I was supposed to be doing, you know, archery or something.
Yeah.
Throwing clay in pottery class. But I was in the bunk alone, and there was a record player, and I put on Electric Ladyland, Gypsy Eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened to it like 5 times in a row. And I'm 12, and I, you know, I astral projected. It's like something happened, you know, like my DNA got rearranged. It just wasn't the same after listening to the song over and over and over again. I mean, I was a huge Beatle fan. My mother was a singer and an actress, and my house was filled with music. So my earliest memories were her record collection, everything from Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday.
The classics, yeah.
And Tony Bennett. But then she also had Chet Atkins records. She had Lead Belly records.
Oh, wow. That does
and go then Segovia. She had Segovia records. Like, you know, so I was
phenomenal
just
player.
Steeped. I was just steeped in all everything. You know, like right. I was too young to think about that any of it was different from anything else. Like Lead Belly, think of it. There's no difference between Lead Belly and Segovia and Tony Bennett. You know,
not
when
at
you're,
all.
When you're three, there isn't. You know, and then she even bought a guitar before I was born, like when she was pregnant with me. So when I showed up, there was a guitar there. So my point in just saying all of this was I had been a music fanatic for a long time, but surrounded by music, and music was very important to me. You know, Roger Miller doing Dang Me, you know, like before the Beatles. I mean, like when the Beatles showed up, that was this, you know, zeitgeist, of course. But then this thing happened listening to Hendrix when I was 12 that I never experienced before, and so Hendrix became my guy, you know, it was just it. And then my first band I started when I was 17, a trio, guitar, bass, drums, and we played literally like 30 Hendrix songs. We played, you know, we played Three Little Bears and Catastrophe and 51st Anniversary. Like, we played the songs no one, you know, we played a song, but people say, who's that by? It was the same answer every time. It was, you know, Jimi Hendrix. It's Jimi Hendrix, you know. Like, you driving south.
You were a tribute band before they were tribute bands.
We were nuts. But then along with the Hendrix stuff, we did Johnny Winter and Leslie West and Deep Purple and Frank Zappa and, you know, Power Trio, you know, Jethro Tull. I love Jethro Tull and Jeff Beck group, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And so anyway, my study of Jimi Hendrix was intense and very, very deep. And then, I started working for guitar magazines in 1984, doing transcriptions, became music editor, started interviewing people.
Oh, wow.
And then started doing music books, transcription books. And I did hundreds, like literally hundreds of books, maybe at least 200 books. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. And then this thing came along, these instructional books with CDs inside, mm-hmm. where songs would be transcribed and there'd be lesson type material. Mm-hmm. And then on the CD, the songs would be, I would recreate to the best of my ability the original record. But the songs would be in segments and then taught. So I did a Jimmy.
Was it tab?
Yeah, the books were in tablature. Yeah. But the CD was the songs, the music.
Right.
And so that book, that specific book, was called Jimi Hendrix Signature Licks for Hal Leonard. And it became the most successful Signature Licks book they ever had. It was a series. And that came out in 1995. Now, the only reason I bring that up is I had gotten to know Steve Ray Vaughan when he was alive and interviewed him a number of times. Which ultimately led to me writing this biography of Steve Ray Vaughan.
Because he was a huge Hendrix fan.
Yes.
I mean, he played, he's the only person I've ever heard play, well, everybody's heard the Austin thing where he's playing Voodoo Child. One of the few people I've heard that could play it pretty damn good.
Exactly.
Really damn good, yeah.
And when I first met Stevie, the first thing that happened was we played together, which was really cool. And he was a year and a half older than me. And, you know, there was a lot of symbiotic stuff there, and he was a really, 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 really nice person, like a really warm and generous and sweet person. Anyway, I got to know him, and I met Chris Layton and Tommy Shannon around that time, but I didn't spend any time with them. If I went to get together with Stevie, it was to interview Stevie, and like I said, we played the first time. And then the other times he would just sit and play my guitar. He didn't have his guitar. He had his guitar the first time. So he would just sit and play my guitar like the whole time, you know. So anyway, then he dies this horrible, tragic death.
1990. Hard to believe 32 years ago.
And I do these interviews with Chris and Tommy and Reese Winans about
that.
He
was a keyboard player, right?
In Double Trouble, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Chris and Tommy formed the Archangels in 92. So I interviewed
Doyle Bramhall. I don't know who that played.
Doyle Bramhall, too, and Charlie Sexton. And then in 95, they had a band called Storyville. So anyway, so I'm getting to know Chris Layton and Tommy Shannon post Stevie.
Right.
And this Jimi Hendrix book comes out where I recreate the songs. And Rick, I mean, not blowing my own horn, it sounds a lot. Sounds pretty damn close. Like, you know, so close, in fact, that I had told Tommy Shannon about it. Now, of course, Tommy met Jimmy because when he was playing with Johnny Winter, there's a famous photograph of Johnny Winter jamming with Jimi Hendrix, and Hendrix is playing a white Fender jazz bass upside down. Mm. That's Tommy's bass.
Oh, okay.
And it was at the Scene Club. And Tommy heard my replications of Hendrix's songs in this book, and he freaked out. He said, I can't believe it's not Hendrix. I can't believe it. Like, is that you, really? And then Mitch Mitchell heard it. And now this is a little later when I started to do those tours with Mitch. And one day he said to me, I'm mad at you. And I said, why? And he said, you used my drum tracks for your book and you didn't ask my permission. And I said, well, I'll tell Ed Cavasano, the guy who's playing drums, my drummer, that
you heard, just like Mitch Mitchell,
that you heard him And you thought it was you, because that's going to be like the greatest day of his life.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That Mitch Mitchell heard his drumming and he thought it was him himself.
Yep.
And so, so then by 98 or 9, I started to do some stuff with Chris and Tommy. I started to,
let me stop right there. What were you doing when you're doing, when Mitch was playing with you? What was?
Wait,
what,
let me get up to, because your question was, okay, how did I get involved?
Okay, keep going. I won't interrupt you. All right, got it.
So, the first thing I did with Chris and Tommy was their instructional videos. They did, Chris did a drum video and Tommy did a bass video, and we shot them at the same time. And they asked me, they said, would you come and play guitar in our videos? Because they knew I knew all the stuff. Like, they heard me play the Hendrix stuff, and then I sent them other stuff. In fact, I sent them tracks. I was in the midst in 98 of putting together my first album, Put a Sock in It. And so they could tell they liked my guitar playing, simple as that. And they could tell that if I was going to be asked to play in a Stevie Ray Vaughan style, I'd probably be able to do it. Or Freddie King or B.B. King, you know, like they could tell from listening that I had studied that stuff. Right. And don't forget, they knew me a little bit from conversations and, you know, hanging out some, you know, over the course of the previous decade.
Sure.
So in 2000, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame did a Jimi Hendrix exhibition to coincide with the release of the Purple 4-CD box set called Jimi Hendrix Experience. And there was lots of different people that played, and the headliner was Double Trouble. Mm. And in that band was Chris and Tommy and me and the singer Malford Milliken from Storyville.
Oh, okay.
So we did that. And I'm in the dressing room, like the other bands are playing, and me and Tommy are just jamming. And who walks in? Billy Cox and Mitch Mitchell. Who, by the way, Chris and Tommy are also, you know, massive fans of, you know.
Yeah.
And Billy looks at me and he just points at me. He goes, I heard about you, which was really funny. And he took Tommy's bass, and then me and Billy jammed for like an hour and a half, like before we even went on. And we played everything. I mean, by everything, I mean, we played free, like we played all the hard ones. We played Freedom and Isabel and Power of Soul and Message.
Stuff off the stuff after he died, the stuff they released afterwards, yeah.
Well, I mean, Band of Gypsies came out while Hendrix was alive, I believe.
Yeah, it did, but I was trying to think, was Freedom on that? I remember, that was afterwards. That was the Cry of Love or whatever.
Freedom's Cry of Love, and that came out.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, even Eddie Kramer still had something to do with engineering on that stuff.
No, he still does.
Yeah.
He still does. But anyhow, and so Mitch Mitchell, come on, you know, like, you know. And so anyway, then when we go out, I'll send you the recording.
I'd love to hear it.
We're going
to
dig it. We open with Spanish Gospel Magic. It's so heavy. Oh, and Hendrix's dad was there. He was standing like 10 feet away from me. And I'm freaking out, Rick.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, I just came out of the dressing room with Mitch Mitchell and Billy Cox. I'm excited anyway because I'm doing a gig with Double Trouble. And then, this is Al Hendrix, Jimmy's dad.
Oh, that's what it was. I was trying to think it was now. Al, yes, it's exactly.
And I'm like, oh. And and then because we followed everybody else, you know, I was feeling like, well, we better kick ass, you know, like.
Yeah, you got to be good.
Because it was Eric Gills, and it was like all these people that were great. So there was a 100-watt, 1968 100-watt half stack there, and I just put every knob on 10. I mean, I did the Johnny Winter move where you just go like this. You just go across the top.
Mine's right behind me. You can't see it. It's right behind me.
All right. I saw Johnny do that at the Lone Star. He was going to sit in with the T-Birds, and they had a super, and his tech was like setting each knob to like a really specific number. And Johnny like fell down the stairs, and I thought he was dead, and then he was fine. And he was super drunk, and he sat in a stool, and they handed him his Firebird and plugged him in, and he went like blah, blah, and he just did the move across all the knobs. He just went beep. So I did that. Open with Spanish Gospel Magic. It's so heavy, Rick.
That's such a cool tune, though. It's such a crushing. Cool tune.
And then the second song is Manic Depression.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like, we really lightened it up. Then we did Angel.
Oh, and then right after did, that? Oh, man.
And then we did I Don't Live Today, which I sang.
Oh, well.
So I'm singing I Don't Live Today, looking at Hendrix's father.
Oh, wow. How weird is that, dude?
I'm not on Earth anymore.
Yeah, I would
so think. So then we were going to do something else. I can't remember. And I had turned around. I think I brought a couple other musicians on stage. And then I turned back, and Mitch is on the drums. Like, Mitch and Billy had walked up, and Mitch took Chris's place, and Billy's putting on Tommy's bass. And I'm just like, you know, and Billy walks over and goes, let's play Voodoo Child. So anyhow, that's how I got.
I assume the slight return is the one you played with the wah-wah in it.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And so that was my introduction into doing Hendrix tribute shows. So we started to do them. That was the first one. And I did them for a bunch of years. And then later, by the time we get to like 2007 or 8, they wouldn't have me do the whole tours, unfortunately. I would have liked to. But I would come and play like the New York, New Jersey shows and the more local shows. And
right.
It was fun. But getting to know, no, it's no slight on Billy. It's wonderful to get to know Billy. But getting to know Mitch and have dinner with Mitch and sit with him and him talk about his life, which was a very difficult life he went through.
I just actually read a little bit about him just the other day. I was reading about.
Oh, he had a child, and very early on, like by 71, his wife disappeared with their 1 or 2 year old baby, and he didn't find his daughter for 20 years or something. And so
all I remember is when they came out, and I told my friend this at lunchtime, when they came out, no intro, but they came out, he put his drums down and they put a 2x4, nailed it to the floor in front of his kick drum.
Yeah, of course.
I guess that was before everybody thought, you know what we could do is we could rugs out. And I thought, he's going to kick the crap out of the thing. But you know the amazing thing to me about listening to Jimi Hendrix was he wasn't that loud. You know, I've heard other people after that were a lot louder. I mean, he had, I don't know how many Marshalls, 3. I don't remember what it was. Right. But, you know, when you talk about 1970, the sound systems are so different now. I mean, you know, it's people.
Well, yeah, it's not going to crush you like that. But I had a conversation just in the last week with Joe Perry. Again, not to at the risk of name dropping, but
that's all right.
Joe is a guy I've gotten to know, you know, from Aerosmith. He's a wonderful guy. He's one of the sweetest people ever. And we've hung out many times, just sit around playing guitar. He's great. He's a great dude. And, you know, I think he's 70 now, but he just is like a kid. He loves guitar and music. And all he wants to talk about, now he's on this kick of finding this thin paper for low wattage speakers, you know, like he's so into it. And, and he was saying exactly what you're saying, that you could stand in front of like original 66, 67 Marshall stacks, and it's much softer than a 72 metal front. Like it's a completely different sound and it's loud, but it's not hard. And this is a guy who saw the original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green at the Boston Tea Party many, 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 many times. And he said every English band that came in would be at least 1 or 2 full stacks behind them in a bar. And it was loud, but he said it was not like your brain was getting crushed. So,
it had to
be great. It had to be amazing to see Hendrix. I can't.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. It's really, and this is kind of a side note. So my buddy and I, he found out about, now we live 250 miles away, but we didn't care. We were going to drive this 4 hours to 5 hours it was to go see him. And we went and saw him. He played an hour. The last song he played was Voodoo Child's Thy Return. In the middle of the set, he played Star Spangled Banner. Everybody stood up. Nobody sat down after that.
Right.
Walked off stage and never came back.
Right.
And what was interesting was my friend and I separated when we got out of high school. didn't see each other for years. And he had a very, has a very common name. And so when Facebook come out, I tried to find him a couple of times. And one time he found me. This has been 40 years after the event. Okay. And so he says, "Hey, do you remember we only saw Jimmy?" And you know how you have some of that stuff in your mind, you think, was that really there or was I just making it up? And then he says this to me, he says, "Remember the guy smoking a cigar in front of us?" And I went, "Oh my God, do you remember that too?" I mean, those little details that I thought, you know, and I actually found one time on the internet the playlist and a picture from him playing at the Hemisphere Arena. Of course, not there anymore. You know, to me, I think, and my story is somewhat similar to yours when it comes to Jimmy. So in 68, when that album came out, the other big album that came out was Tommy. That was the year Tommy came out, okay?
I saw the Who in 68.
And so all my friends are like, "I'm going to get Tommy." And I go, "Nah, I'm going to get Jimi Hendrix." And they're like, "Oh, what's Jimi Hendrix?" And I had heard Jimmy, the first time I heard him, I was a freshman in high school during a football game. Went down to see a football game in high school where I was at. Friend says, "You got to come over and listen to this guy play on this album." And it was, what was this? Not X's Boldest Love. What was the first one called?
Are You
Experienced. So he puts on Our Experience, and I go, "Who is this guy?" And that's kind of where it went for me. And then so when I listened to Electric Ladyland, I told my parents, who had a Magnavox record player, you know, the big wooden things and all that stuff, no headphone jack, but I got a converter where I could plug, you know, screw the wires in and put a headphone in, and sat there and listened to this mix going, "Holy crap." Stuff going around my head and all that. So I didn't know how sonically, and I went, "I don't know what this is." So that's kind of where I went from. And then, of course, when he passed away, but then I bought all the stuff afterwards.
I got a good story for you. So I'm backstage at the Beacon Theater in, I don't know what year it was. I'm guessing 2008 or 9. I don't know. We're doing a Hendrix tribute show. And I'm sitting with Eric Johnson, who I'd gotten to know, you know,
Texas player,
great guy. Incredible guitar player, giant Hendrix fan. And we're just talking, and then these two guys walk in with a guitar case and plop it down and open it, and they go, "Here's Jimmy's Strat that he played at Woodstock." You know? And Rick, it was like meeting one of the Beatles or something, you know? It's like, and I'm looking at the guitar.
And you're like, "Should I even touch it?
No, there was no question of whether I was going to cut it. That's for sure. But I'm looking at it thinking, this guitar launched a million ships. You know what I mean? This is the Star Spangled Banner guitar where we all watched in the movie, the Woodstock movie. Yeah. We've all heard it. It changed the world. You know, if a guitar player plays the Star Spangled Banner at a baseball game now, they're going to play it like Hendrix.
Yep.
It's, you know, as American as apple motherfucking pie at this point.
That's exactly right.
And when Hendrix was on the Dick Cavett show a couple days after Woodstock.
Was that when, I've seen that clip, but I never didn't know when it was. So it's right after Woodstock then.
Well, he was on a couple times. So one of the times.
One of them, he had a kind of a funky looking, looked like a pajama outfit or something on it that was,
well, he wore kimonos one time.
That's right, that
blue
was
one
on. Yeah,
blue one, I think, is it was a couple days after Woodstock, and Cabot asked him, "You know, are you like a very disciplined person, you know, do you get up and work every day?" And Jimmy goes, "Well, I try to get up every day." Like, he's so amazing. And so Cabot asked him, he said, "Did you get any angry letters, you know, or any flack?"
For playing a Star Spangled Banner?
And he went, "Well, why? Why would anybody?" And he goes, "Well, anytime you take a song like that, you know, National Anthem, and you do it in an unorthodox way." And Jimmy just goes, "Unorthodox?" He goes, "It wasn't unorthodox." He goes, I thought it was beautiful."
Yeah.
And so people start clapping and cheering. And Jimmy goes like this, And then he goes like this, which says like everything you need to know about him, because it's like we're talking about being unorthodox.
Right. Yeah.
And he goes like this, which everybody understands. And then it was sort of like, but why not this? You know, he goes like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, dude, does it matter?
Does it matter? You
know? Like, he's so ahead of everybody.
Well, that was such a weird interview, because it would be like me interviewing Lawrence Welk. I mean, because
no, Cavett was.
I mean, he was okay, but you know,
yeah, he was pretty. He was. I'm going to give him credit. Cavett, in fact, in that interview, Cavett was funny. He refers to him as Hendrix, just as a joke. Yeah. He goes, "Listen, Hendrix."
Well, that was back when they used the word cats, and Hendrix is always talking, "Hey, man, dude." Never used dude, and didn't use dudes back. He's a cool, and he talked about one of the things that he talked about on one of the shows was when he met Billy Gibbons, because right. That's when, and he talks about moving sidewalks with Billy and all that stuff, and how great Billy Gibbons was. I you know what amazes to me is that you were talking just a second ago, how one person can impact so many people. How many thousands, if not millions, of people has Hendrix influenced to pick up the guitar and play it?
Not only millions. I mean, it's across like five generations at this point.
I mean, now look at it.
It's never going to stop. And I tell this to people all the time. Like when we were young, people would argue, who's the best rock guitar player?
Yeah.
You know? Oh, Hendrix. Oh, no, I think it's Clapton. Oh,
yeah, they talk about Clapton.
Oh, I think it should be Page. So my son is 30. To his generation, there isn't even a discussion. The question is like, it's so cut and dried. It's like if I asked you who's first president of the United States, there's one answer.
Yeah, George Washington.
There's no debate.
There's no debate.
If you ask anyone in my son's generation who's the greatest rock guitar player ever lived, the answer is Jimi Hendrix.
There's no Eddie Van Halen. There's no Eric Clapton.
There's no debate. Hmm. There's Hendrix, and there's everybody else. And that's it's just the way they filtered it from when they were young. It was obvious to them. I mean, to me, the proof's really in the pudding. You know, we are in the midst of so much different stuff that, you know, from a distance, looking at things, you know, with a different perspective, to my son's generation, it's like a silly conversation.
Why are we talking about this?
It's like, how could you compare anyone to Jimi Hendrix? It's insane. Yeah. Like, you must be nuts.
Here's Andy playing with Mitch Mitchell, Billy Cox, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Freedom.
Bye.
You know, I wonder, though, Andy, if when they were sitting there recording, and of course, Kramer did a lot of that stuff, but I wonder if he knew at the time that he was seeing. I mean, it's always easy to say stuff years later or a few years later about Jimmy, but I wonder when they were, I always wonder about this when iconic songs become iconic, whether it's sitting there and they're listening to Voodoo Child. I know Jimmy did a lot of different things in the studio and all that stuff. But if you're sitting there and listening to it, do they turn to each other and go, holy crap, this is something that's going to last forever? Or they just didn't know. They just knew he was different. And
this is, oh, go ahead. I mean,
No, that's all I was going to say.
This is what I think. I do think, and I do think this is true for all of the most important music. And I'll even expand it to other art forms. Painting, because I've got a degree in art. I don't know if you know that. I went to the School of Visual Arts and got a degree in art and was much more involved in art for most of my life, or at least up until I was 17 and I started to play guitar like a psychopath. But I think when you listen to Miles Davis records and Charlie Parker records, that part of what's getting, part of what got captured is the some level of awareness and acknowledgement of the musicians that they're doing something extraordinary. Like they're experiencing it too. Mm-hmm. Like you could listen to Coco or, you know, a variety of things from Charlie Parker, you know, the Bird and Diz record. Or Jazz Massey Hall, the level of excitement in that music is always going to sound as fresh as the day it was recorded because it's totally real. Mm-hmm. And I do think that Manic Depression sounds the way it does because they, in the studio, were as excited as anybody could be about what was happening. Because it had not happened before.
No.
They didn't hear it anywhere else before they did it. So you could say the same thing about Cream, especially Cream Live. No one else did what they did. They fed off of it themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's in their recording. So
but you know,
I don't think you could have, you know, like there's no way Hendrix could know when he did All Along the Watchtower that it would be this thing later.
No.
But he definitely he wanted it to be as good as he could make it, and he made it really, really, really good.
Every day in the week I have to leave the city. If I stay too long, people try to down. They talk about me like a dime. Talk about the clothes I wear. But they don't realize they're the ones who swear.
Thanks for watching or listening to part one of the Andy Aldort interview. What you're hearing right now is a little bit of Andy playing off his brand new album release, Light of Love. For more information about Andy, you can pick up his music on his website at andyaldort.com, or it's available on all major streaming services. For more information about The Trout Show, you know where to go, thetroutshow.com. So until next time, remember, people, it's only rock and roll, but we love it. See ya.